Okay, are we live? Yes, okay. Well, thank you. Welcome everyone participating either physically in the library of Sonderburg or watching this from the internet. Yes, you are here at the Hex on the Harbor 2023, hashtag HotHar23. And we are having now a structured AMA, a conversation called What the F is Up with You, a conversation about digital politics in the present and future with Karen Melchior. And I'm really happy to welcome Karen Melchior here and asking her some question about her work in Europe and obviously digital EU politics.
Well, thank you so much for welcoming me, and it's good to see known faces in the audience, and I hope that there are known faces in the on the internet as well. And thanks for inviting me.
Yes. So let's get started with like the first thing. So could you maybe tell us something about, maybe start at really the beginning. So can you maybe explain what's your role or what is like you're an MEP, but what does it really mean? Could you just explain that a little bit?
Well, I'm elected from all of the Europeans living in Denmark and all of the Danes living in Europe to the European Parliament, which is a little bit like the Bundestag in Germany, but just for all of Europe. And for all of the things digital, even Europe is quite small, but Europe is the biggest entity within Europe. So that's where we try and regulate all things internet. And that's where it makes sense, even though that all of the member states sometimes try and say that they can do things on their own. I actually started as a lawyer and a diplomat, and then I found out what actually having a networked organization means and how important that is. Then there was I was following people tweeting at the time about CCC in Hamburg, and then I came to CCC in 2013. And then you had, before then you'd had the Arab Spring and the Arab Revolutions, and then you had the Snowden revelations, and then I decided that, okay, we need to actually have some politicians that kind of listen to what's going on technologically. We managed to defeat ACTA in the European Parliament, but okay, going forward, how do we actually do these things in a way that makes sense? So I usually say I don't know a lot about tech, but I know enough to know that I need to ask somebody that knows more.
Okay, that sounds already really interesting. I would like to get to the point, because this is like a cross-border event. So we have like a German organization organizing an event, but in Denmark, inviting everyone from Denmark and Germany. So how does it work? Because in the end, like the European Union works like we are all these member states, not just Germany and Denmark. And you are in the parliament representing like all of them.
I'm in the parliament representing all of them, but I'm elected in Denmark. Yeah. I'm sitting in a political group, which is a little bit like the fraktions in Germany or the political parties in Denmark and elsewhere. But that is like composed, we're around 100 members of parliament in this group. And it's composed of multiple parties from both the Netherlands and also from Denmark. There are three parties represented from Denmark, for example. And from Germany, you have the FDP and also the Freie Wähler, I think they're called, that are then all together in the same group. We get the proposals for legislation from the Commission. They send it to the member states and they send it to the Parliament. And then we need to tell the Commission what we think about it. And we need to reach a compromise with the member states. And that then becomes European law. So, for example, we had the proposal on Digital Services Act, which is basically the European Union trying to regulate online platforms. And we have Digital Markets Act, which is trying to regulate like competition and interoperability with the platforms. So we get that from the Commission, and then we look at it in the Parliament. And I then collaborate with people that agree with my political views and interests from other countries as well within my group, but also from other groups. So, for example, I often work together with a Dutch SND, that's Social Democrat, called Paul Tang. And I also work with Patrick Breyer from the Pirates in the Green Group, but also Sergei Lagodinsky, who is in the Greens and also in the... And then I also work with all of my FDP colleagues, both Svenja Hahn from Hamburg and also Moritz Körner from more for the Southwest, that have similar views to me on digital policy. I might have, for example, French or Spanish colleagues in my own group, but that I don't agree with on digital issues. And therefore, it's difficult for me to work with them on that. For example, on copyright issues, then the French are all very sort of influenced by the industry and their rights holders. We're looking at doing a report on geo-blocking at the moment, and we can see the amendments coming from all of the French and Spanish colleagues are highly industry influenced. So you have sort of interests that you work together around, no matter political group or nationality. And then you also have some colleagues that are working more influenced on national industries, copyright directive in the previous mandate, geo-blocking, piracy of live sporting events. You can see that there are French and Spanish colleagues that all have the same opinion, no matter which political group they're in.
Okay, maybe can you? Is there like some confrontation between, would you say, like the Danish position on digital politics and like the German position? Is there something that comes in mind, or would you say that we are similar, or how do you view that from like the European Parliament perspective?
There is a lot more awareness in Germany of the importance of privacy and digital rights than there is in Denmark. So, for example, on chat control, CSAM or CSAR, which is a proposal from the Commission to do client-side scanning of pictures or videos that you upload to platforms and encrypted messages services. Then Denmark and the Danish political parties haven't really opposed it as strongly as they have in Germany or in Sweden. And I think that's also because you have a lot more trust in public authorities and the state in Denmark than you have in Germany. So Denmark is probably where some of us are doing some lobbying towards Danish audience and also Danish politicians. But so far, Denmark is probably going to vote for this proposal when it's in the council, whereas Germany is voting against.
Yeah. Okay, so we already heard about a lot of topics I have on my list.
Sorry.
I hope I'm not jumping too much, but maybe we can go further into chat control. First of all, what is like your opinion on that?
It's one of these typical digital regulation proposals where it's difficult to be against like the formal objective. Like, who doesn't want to save kids from being sexually abused? Who doesn't want to stop terrorism? I mean, it's like everybody wants that end objective. But the problem is you try and use a technological fix to solving a societal issue. And you also try and get the digital companies to spend a lot of money on something that looks good on paper but doesn't work. And that's sort of the starting point. And then also, if you look at the details in the proposal, then a lot of the questions that we've asked on a technical level to the Commission, they haven't been able to explain the choices that they've made or explain how it would work in practice. So it's sort of, it looks nice. You can take a picture of Ashton Kutcher and say, we are saving the kids, but you're not actually going to achieve anything in real life.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting how some non-EU members, persons are really involved in these decisions.
They might have interests in the organization that is promoting a scanning solution that could be bought if we...
So we already heard that there's like some quite a big push from like industries to set a tone of a regulation, which is quite opposed to like what like CCC or what like I think also our small hacker association thinks of, because that is like a civil society point, what is there. If we talk about chat control, but not only chat control, how do you think is an effective way for us, like the people, or like as association, to influence this decision on a European level? Is that even possible? Or how does it work to voice your opinions or concerns?
It definitely works to voice your opinions and concerns. The challenge is to find the right timing of when to do it. Because often when it hits the national media or the national politicians, the negotiations have been going on for a long time in Brussels. So, for example, chat control was proposed, I think, in May last year.
Mm-hmm.
But we already knew that it was coming. So you should actually, even before the proposal is come officially from the Commission, you should be influencing the parliamentarians. How do you do that? You know that you have to do it, first of all, getting to know that. And then, for example, joining, there is like a hacker conference seminar called Freedom Not Fear, which is usually in the fall every year. And like there's like sponsored visits. You also come in and have a look at the parliament. Join that, try and see if you can link it with meeting with some of the parliamentarians and explaining the issues that some of the legislation will have. Try and link it with, for example, associations of librarians or something that is a little bit broader than just the digital rights community, so that it has a wider appeal. For example, the chat control issue, I think it's also important to get some of the children's rights organizations in on this, because there are a lot of, for example, hotlines helping kids that have experienced horrible things or who are at risk. And they are saying that a lot of the resources that's going to be used for this scanning exercise and also creating a European center is actually going to hinder their work. So to try and sort of use the full register of arguments and also try and enlarge the community and create allies for the cause.
Okay, that's also really much information.
Sorry for answering so long. Please
no,
just
no problem,
stop me
no
along.
Problem. I think we are talking about a really complicated topic, and understanding this is quite important. One thing you mentioned is like the timeline things. So just like in a general EU parliamentary timeline, the next election will be
Between the 6th and the 9th of June 2024, so in about 10 months.
Okay, and like a normal, and like the last election was on then probably on 2017?
The last election was 2019.
Ah, okay. Getting my math together.
Every 5 years.
Yeah.
Around May, June.
So what does it mean for like the timeline of this laws? I imagine that probably between sessions where is probably not happening so much, like going from like one session of the parliament to like the next one. So how long does like a chat control really take from like, I don't know, someone has an idea to where is like a good thing to implement? Like what are the time frames from like this legal proceedings?
The chat control came in a little bit later. I think the Swedish commissioner had it as one of the things that she wanted to do. But it sort of came up in discussions in Brussels, probably 2021, 2020. But for example, if you look at the regulation of online platforms, this was something that was sort of underlined, already mentioned in 2019 in her opening speech. And that I was actually quite impressed that it has entered into force for the very large online platforms already last week, I think. And I expected it to be at the very end of the mandate and enter into force like in a year or so. If you want to influence what the next commission and the next parliament will be working on, you need to think about, okay, what do we want to have changed or to do? And then try and see, okay, where do we need legislation on this? And then try and talk with, do you know EDRI, the European Digital Rights Organization, which is like collecting from, for example, ITPOL and also CCC, maybe CCC, but might
yeah, definitely yeah. CCC is yeah. a member of EDRI.
I wasn't quite sure if the organization was as like organization-ish to be a member, but I know that they, no, I, but I mean,
it's a complicated system because you have all local associations. You have like this, not national, but also representing like people from Austria or like Austria. So it's like complicated thing. Yeah,
exactly. So I wasn't quite sure if they were like a formal member, but that they get help on them to try and influence the commission and saying that we need legislation on this so that they can put that into their catalog of proposals to the next commissioners of what they will be doing legislation on. Because they're the civil servants in the commission, they're preparing this already now, and then that will then be put into legislation if everything goes well.
Okay, so maybe take like chat control still as an example. What is like a thing you can do? Because you're not like the only MEP. We are like, I think, I want to say 500, but I'm not quite sure, 500-ish MEPs from all over Europe. Like what is like your possible influence on doing that? Could you maybe explain that? What's like an influence from like one MEP possible?
You get the proposal from the commission. Then everybody in the parliament, they then fight and bicker about which committee in the parliament will be the one in charge of a proposal. Because they then write the response to the commission about what we think needs to be changed in their proposal.
Hmm.
The committees that didn't get to be the ones in control, but that think that they are relevant for the proposal, they then do what's called an opinion to the report from the parliament, where they then say, we think that you should consider these aspects within our sort of remit, our subject area, and you should include that. Depending on how the fight about who gets influence turned out, then the main committee, they can then either just put it in the bin or they have to actually listen to it. But it's a good way of pointing out what you as an MEP think about a proposal and also what that committee thinks about a proposal. So, for example, in the chat control, this is a Liebe piece. That's the Fundamental Rights Committee. That's the main committee on this. But, for example, the Equality and Gender Committee called FAM is an opinion-giving committee. So Swedish Social Democrat is the rapporteur on it, but I'm what's a sort of so-called shadow rapporteur. So I then negotiate with the rapporteur in my committee about what we should write to the opinion-giving committee that will then be the response to the commission. And there I was able to put in a lot of amendments, criticizing technical aspects. They were then thrown away for technical reasons because the Social Democratic Swedish rapporteur got the Social Democratic chair of the committee to say that they were out of scope because it wasn't relevant for the remit of our committee. But we were able to send a signal about this and emphasize the problems that there is with the proposal. And we had meetings with the commissioner and asked both her and her staff questions that they couldn't actually answer on, like, how is your proposal actually going to work? Do you, like, pointing out the places where they actually didn't know what was happening? I worked together with my colleagues, for example, Moritz Körner from FDP, who is in the Liebe committee, who made a lot of amendments and is collaborating also with others in the Liebe committee about trying to get rid of the proposal. And these have been tabled and they are being like integrated in the Liebe committee report. That's sort of the official way of doing things. And then you also have like internally in my political group, we've had discussions about this because we're quite divided. A lot of the MEPs that like the proposal are the ones sort of writing our opinions, like our shadow rapporteurs in the different committees. But we had like a internal group meeting where there were quite some confrontation with the proponents of the proposal and those of us who want to defend digital rights, sort of saying this is not actually going to be working. You can sort of circumvent the hashing system. It's not going to be reliable. Using AI is going to be even worse. And also that it's going to be a major risk for like queer teens living in non-like like with parents that are not accepting, and also if you look at trans rights in Florida and in Hungary, and what's happening with mothers in lesbian families, like rainbow families in Italy, you can see how if you open up for saying you can like filter, you can scan for material that you deem is inappropriate, like for saving the kids, then it could be quite a slippery slope and would be detrimental. And that confrontation internally in the group shifted some opinions in, for example, the Liebe and also the IMCO committees working on this. And we've made people aware well in advance of the vote in the plenary that this is highly problematic and they can't just listen to the one who's the rapporteur or the shadow rapporteurs.
Okay. So, it's a good sum up of what is like your power in like this. I think you did bring up one interesting point. Like, for example, our association did some protests against like Article 13, it was called then. It was like the, it's also like scanning of content which is uploaded for...
This was from the copyright directive.
Yeah,
from before the last elections. And that had a big resonance, especially because a lot of young people heard about it. And a lot of the debates that we had before the election campaigns, a lot of people raised copyright. And I had a lot of colleagues that didn't know anything about it, but they kept being asked about it and confronted about it. And even some of them said, well, my children are confronting me and asking about what's going on. So it works.
Yeah, definitely. We also had like one, I think our first protest was like with 300 people in Flensburg. I personally called MEPs and had like interesting conversation. And one thing which wondered me in the end, so my perspective is that I'm a software developer, so I'm more familiar with like the software side of it. That I was quite confused that I had the feeling that a lot of MEPs had a lot of hope in technology, what it could do, but it could differentiate between a satire and copyrighted material. So that's like one question from which I have. How is like this, I say digital technology competence, how is this getting into the parliament? What's like, how do you see it? How do we get advised? And how do we make sure that it's like on a technology sound system? And not just like someone who's promoting like their own software product.
The problem is there's like 705 of us, and it's mainly the person who's the rapporteur and the shadow rapporteur and the different committees, or opinion giving committees, that are directly involved in the file. The rest of them rely on the advice that they're being given by their colleagues. And most politicians aren't that interested in how technology actually works, but they want to achieve the objectives that are like the headline of things. And so they will listen to the colleague in charge, and they will listen to the commission, and they usually use technology as kind of magic wand that makes society's problems go away. And you need to break through that barrier in order to get them to understand that it doesn't work like that. For example, if you are scanning for something, I mean, you will be having some false positives and false negatives. And how do you integrate that? What is the effect going to be? What are the numbers going to be? And then, so you need to get them to understand those aspects. And then the problem as well is that often if there is like a conflict and they don't really understand how it will work, they will kind of like not have very precise language. And then they will just hope that the companies will find a solution. So, for example, in the copyright directive, they're saying we don't want any upload filters, but you need to take down copyrighted material within a very short time frame. So you're saying you're not allowed, you need to achieve something that you can only achieve by using this, like an upload filter. But at the same time, you're not allowed to, I think they formulated it otherwise, and you're not allowed to use an upload filter, but you shouldn't like restrict freedom of speech and you shouldn't like be excessive. So you're basically asking companies to do two things at the same time, and then they're going to do the thing that will get them into less trouble. And if you have like big rights holders that are going to sue them, then or remove access to, for example, music videos, if they don't like play along, then they will rather take down more stuff than take down too little. Sorry if that was not very optimistic, but...
We have some optimistic questions, but rather for the end. That's, I think, one thing which is noticeable, that we are like at the moment quite a lot of things moving on the European level in like the digital regulation. I think one thing that is especially for me is a little bit more hopeful is like the Digital Services Act. You mentioned it briefly, and this is actually going in effect now. And this is mainly for like really large companies. So we're talking about like Amazon or Google or like their counterparts. Could you maybe talk a little bit about this? So what is like the effect? And from like your perspective, would you say this is a good win for the civic society?
I think this is a huge win for digital regulation and also quite a win for civil society. This is the first time really that there is regulation of online platforms, and it is a regulation of the tools being used and the system set up by the platforms, and it's not about the content. So it's, for example, saying if you get a post taken down, that you need to have a reason for why it's been taken down, you need to have the possibility to appeal that decision, and you need to be able to take the platform to court if you don't agree with the decision after the appeal. So it's trying to make the system of how, for example, content moderation is working a lot better. And it's also banning dark patterns. So, for example, buying a ticket on Ryanair, that you don't end up buying a lot of stuff that you didn't actually want to buy when you just wanted to get the ticket. And then it's also having more transparency about who is paying for advertisement and who is responsible for pages or accounts. And also it is linked with the Digital Markets Act, which is more on the sort of competition side, which is asking for interoperability, for example, and also reducing the amount of monopolies that you can have in the digital sphere. The hoodie that I'm wearing is from one of the case communication congresses, which was about sort of walled gardens and how the online platforms were like making the internet into silos. And this is some of the... this is one of the ways that we want to try and approach that. And if you look at what Facebook has done, Meta has done with Threads, for example, they are saying that it's a federated service and that you can like access it from different applications, yet to see how that works because they can't follow EU law. So that's why it's not been launched in the EU yet. But, I mean, they're at least paying lip service to the ideas within the legislation.
Okay, so that's like a legislation for really big companies?
It's also going to be for just big companies, but it's entered into force already now for the very big companies, and I think next year it's going to enter into force for just big companies. The very small platforms, it's not going to enter... They don't have as many demands as the big and the very big platforms. Trying to sort of scale it to how big the platform is in order to not impose too harsh burdens on, for example, community-based platforms, that they have to live up to the same stuff that, for example, YouTube or Meta has to do. Because that was one of the problems as well with the copyright directive, that there was no distinction between the different platforms.
Yeah. So I think you mentioned interoperability, and that is an interesting point because one topic we also have, which is also digital in a way, is like living in a border region. So we are from Flensburg, we're Sventus in Sonderburg, we are crossing a border, which is now without a control. If you want to go by car, that's great. But there are some other issues, like if you want to go by bus from Flensburg to Sonderburg, you can buy a digital ticket in like an app, but this app, for example, is not using or having like the common digital payment means which are used in Germany. So do you see movement like from this side on like Europe also like going for interoperability in like, I say this bus company is not huge, it's not Amazon, but it would be great for us as a border region if you could grow together. Is there some movement you see from this side to make it like easier to really live a European life with not really noticeable borders if it's not necessary?
On the sort of more digital sphere of things, we're not going to regulate on the EU level regarding the app for the transport company.
Obviously.
you should allow all payment forms, digital payment forms in all apps, but I think that would be a little bit too harsh. But we are looking at allowing for having like a digital wallet and an e-identity at a European level so that you can have digitally verifiable, for example, university diplomas and driver's license and other things so that you can use that to identify yourself, approve your diploma or whatever to authorities in other EU countries without having like a specially signed and stamped physical copy. So that's one thing. And then we're trying to look at having a reform of the geo-blocking regulation, which is restricting the access to copyrighted material into specific regions that are smaller than the single market, so that you don't have access to the same things in Germany that you have in Greece or in Denmark. We're trying to see if we can improve that. There's going to be a lot of pushback in like having a proper single market for copyrighted material. But at least for border regions and for linguistic minorities, we want to make sure that you can have access to German material in Denmark or Danish material in Germany, so that if you're living as a German in Sønderborg, part of the German minority in Sønderborg, that you have access to all of the cultural aspects that you want digitally, and the opposite if you're living in Flensburg as part of the Danish minority.
Yeah, I think that's also a really interesting thing because especially people from, I would say, South Germany, like Hamburg onwards, don't really know like what like a cultural diversity it is actually in like these border regions. We have like the Danish minority, which we are closely connected to as an association. We are in German, it's called Friesen. So we are like so many language minorities who are quite hard hit by this, like also like the Danish, the German minority on like the Danish side, which is from my point of view, or like our point of view, is computers or digital systems could be such an awesome way because you don't have a limitation of physical space, so you just can translate things. You just have space, but and like if you bought a DVD like 10 years ago, it didn't ask on which side of the border you were playing it, but on like digital services, you have like this geo blocking issues. So that's really interesting. Do you maybe have like one shorter take on like cybersecurity and cyber attacks? Because that's like one thing which is like increasing, either from like domestic sources or like, from abroad. Is Europe prepared, doing well on this? Is this like on an agenda, like the cybersecurity topic?
It is on the agenda. I'm trying to restrict myself not to do everything digital because then I could do it. But there is like the Cyber Resilience Act that has come through, and we've looked at making sure that we take into account like open source software in this. And for me, I think it's also really important that you have good bounty programs and you use that as a tool of like discovering flaws and bugs. And so that's sort of been my work on that. And there has been a lot more attention on cybersecurity in the last couple of years, and especially with what happened with what's called NotBetya and Maersk and in Ukraine, even before the total invasion from Russia into Ukraine.
Yeah, in Germany we have like some like local governments who are like offline for weeks or months because we have been hacked, mostly not intentionally, but just as an standbyer by someone who wants to extort them. So that's like also a point, like in Germany, really for some people, quite annoying.
And there was a hosting service in Denmark that had a ransomware attack where I think for the Danes amongst you, Chili Klaus, he had like an online shop and he lost all of his data. And I mean, this is important and serious business. I'm negotiating a product liability directive, which is basically if you get a damage because the product you were using was faulty, and I'm have to discuss with my colleagues whether or not we should include corrupted or lost data in that. And they're saying, oh, but I mean, it's too difficult to take into account the value of that. But I mean, digital stuff has a value and is important if you lose it. Data is important. So, yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like I have like two topics left from like my list. One is, if we think back, especially now it's quite a long time ago, but the cases of Edward Snowden or Julian Assange with WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden with like his leaks about the American government doing spy stuff. We haven't, as Europe, like not really invited them, even for where informed us about like a lot of things which is also happening with like European data. What is your take, and do you see any hope? I have known that there is like now a whistleblower protection from like the government side, but Edward Snowden is still in Russia, and and Julian Assange is still in Britain in custody and is fighting against his extradition. Like, what's your take on that? And do you see there maybe some positive movement from like the European side, or is it still really, in like this 10-year-old position?
I mean, I've been advocating that Julian Assange should have asylum in Europe so that he could get out of Russia. I've been doing that ever since he was there, left Hong Kong. And I don't think that Julian Assange should be extradited to the US. So I've like, been part of sort of advocating for that. But with the sort of geopolitical situation, there is not that much of a positive movement towards that. So there needs to be more pressure on this. And I think it's also really important that we ensure strong whistleblower protection, also within security services. And that this is actually the whistleblower protection that we have in Denmark, for example, actually comes from EU legislation. So often member states will take credit for something that's actually European stuff. But there isn't actually that much like positive for the two persons that you mentioned. But I think there is more awareness of the sort of intelligence and security community. There is a lot of debate in Denmark about the revelations that Snowden made regarding a Danish contribution to possibly surveilling cables that run through Denmark. And this has, I mean, some former ministers have been like expressing, saying something about this, and there's now a court case against it. So there is more awareness of this in Denmark than there used to be, but I don't think there really is enough at the moment still. But I mean, it's moving towards something better, but yeah.
Okay, and so we talked a lot about a lot of ugly things. I think especially like these two cases is really some downsides. And we would like to end like this structured AMA on like on a positive note, or try on that. So the question would be, what or like one topic we also really try to explore in like our association is that we shouldn't just only look at like the negative sides. What is like, what should we fight against, but also really what should we fight for? So what is your personal utopia for Europe look like? And because this is a really hard way to look at it, so just say, what are like the positive changes you wish for in the next 10 years, especially if we are like in the brink of the next election, which will definitely or probably change like the parliament makeup. So what's like your utopia for Europe and what's your wish for what things could happening?
I would wish that people are more aware of what's going on in border regions, because I think that border regions really highlight the problems with European integration, that the transport companies across the border don't really talk with each other, that they don't use the same material, that the personnel on the trains can't go all the way to Copenhagen from Hamburg and vice versa. I mean, why do they need to get out in Pelbo rather than going all the way to Hamburg? And that you can't get data from, for example, your trains when you're in Denmark on your Deutsche Bahn app or on your Reiseplane. So that you think about like a better practical integration of Europe. And then I hope that we have more of a European debate about what's actually going on politically, so that we can have the discussion about, for example, digital regulation when it's actually possible to change it, and not only when it reaches the national media and the national parliaments. And then I hope that we have a lot more support for research and education across European states, and we have a lot more exchanges with students living and working in other countries. And then that we have an enlargement that will include some of the candidate countries now, that we have Ukraine joining the European Union, that we have the Western Balkan moving away from sort of repressive national conservative regimes and being more democratic, and that we have a stop for these sort of anti-democratic movements also in Poland and in Hungary, so that we have a better respect for the fundamental rights of everybody in society and have free movement of all families and kids and parents to have equal rights across Europe, including recognition of parenthood.
So that's a really long wish list, but yeah, thank you for this. So which is like that was like the part of a structured AMA. And we have been talking quite a lot. We haven't touched to all the questions, so I'm sorry if you submitted a question and we couldn't get to it. Are there some audience questions right now?
And sorry about answering for so long.
Yeah, I just will go around, but try not to be in the camera, so don't. Yeah.
Okay. I saw on the European Parliament website that you are part of the delegation for relations with South Caucasus. I want to ask, how do you address those digital policies to non-EU countries, to those parliaments that are outside the European Union? How are digital policy approached outside the EU, outside?
We try and collaborate on digital policy when we have sort of inter-parliamentary meetings where parliamentarians from, for example, South Caucasus comes and meets with us, and then we do like joint reports about what visions and political ambitions we have on this. Unfortunately, the collaboration isn't so close that it could be. For example, stopping use of spyware, for example, in South Caucasus would be great.
Okay. I see where we are.
I have a question. You've been talking about an e-wallet for European Union where you can have everything. My question is, how would that affect our rights to privacy, and how similar is that, for example, with the initiatives that China has been doing with their social credit score? So would that be a move towards a society where we are going to be evaluated based on other types of criteria, which would also impact our like, credit eligibility or our education eligibility or our lives as a whole?
It has nothing to do with social scoring or like eligibility for social or other economic rights. It's purely a way of having a verified digital copy of your documents that you can choose to use to share with authorities elsewhere that they then sort of have to trust. And it's also part of a system where you could, for example, use age verification where you don't need to disclose your identity, so you could be anonymous on online platforms but still say I'm above the age of 16 without them knowing who you are, where you live, what your social security number is.
Okay.
Hey, thanks. Nice talk. A lot of details. I like that. What do you think now, spontaneously, how do the member states of the European Union rank regarding their tendency towards or against protection of privacy?
Germany is probably top of the thoughts on privacy. Sweden as well is very high up. Poland as well is surprisingly higher than I thought they would be. The Netherlands is usually quite good, but it also a little bit depends on who's in power. They have a sort of coalition government at the moment, where the VVD is less pro-privacy than, for example, the D66 is. Bottom of the ranks would probably be, for example, France, that is also looking at doing a lot of scanning to sort of have access control regarding the Olympic Games next year. Mm-hmm. That's sort of my initial thought on sort of ranking the countries. One good news about the chat control, it looks like we could have a blocking minority in the council. So it's really good if we keep up the pressure on the member states and try and make sure that they block it.
Okay, second question. I think that will be the last one.
Okay, thank you very much. You have tangentially touched on the AI Act, and I would like to ask for the students among us, will we see the AI becoming available as a study tool in universities? I mean, would that be integrated into the educational system at the EU level? Because it is a tool that we have access to, and it should be implemented in a way or another to help us develop ourselves.
It's nothing that the EU will be imposing or saying that the educational systems or universities need to do. I think we need to have a sort of rethink of how we do education. We need to like switch the classrooms around. And also instead of like doing homework and then bringing it in and getting it corrected, you do the homework in the classroom and have a discussion about how you're thinking about it. But it's not something that's going to come through the AI Act. The AI Act is going to say, okay, if you use it within education, you need to be transparent about it, and you can't like use it as sort of social scoring. And thanks a lot for all of the questions, if we're running out of time.
Yeah, we definitely.
And I'm going to hang around for a bit if you have more questions, and you can find me on Mastodon and on what was formerly called Twitter and Instagram, and I have a website as well.
Very cool. That's all your socials. So, first of all, thanks to the library in Sonderburg for hosting us. Thank you to the Chaoticum e.V. and people from No Breakspace to making this live stream possible, and also creating the video, which will be available afterwards online. And also, thank you very much for coming here from Brussels and having all your talks. I would try to do the same thing we did in the introduction round of you, just one clap on three to say just thank you for everyone. So, 1, 2, 3. Okay, and that's it. So I would say bye-bye, Internet. We will see you next year or somewhere else.